Yeah, I forgot to write down last time how far I had gotten on my notes. I think I had discussed whether the examples satisfied the conditions of the structure theorem for cross products. Is that right?
Yeah, you're right, 2, 5, and 7.
Yeah. Did I? Yeah, but it may not have been in quite the order I have it in my notes, because I was trying to make sure to get that finished. Did I at least mention the machinery of Gray Exel? I wasn't going to actually say anything serious about it, but I did at least mention it. Yes. And did I? Mention the corollary to the effect that informally the cross product is classifiable.
The corollary is a term.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
All right. Okay, so today I want to talk about the proof of the theorem with Huaxing Lin for the specific case that X is the Cantor set. So throughout today, X is the Cantor set, and X to X is a minimal homeomorphism. Was there anything I should check? Did I mention that the tracial states on the cross product correspond to invariant measures on the on X? Yes, I got that. Okay. So this is what I'm doing is certainly ahistorical. In fact, Ian Putnam proved up to one minor thing involving semi-projectivity, that in this case you actually get an AT algebra, and this was proved directly without relying on any sort of classification theorem. In fact, the only classification theorem that was known at the time was the Elliott's AF theorem. If you take what I'm going to do now and then combine it with the classification theorem for tracial AF C-span algebras, this makes certainly a much longer proof of the result than Putnam's original proof. I want to do it this way anyway because the Cantor set case provides a good demonstration of the principles, and then what I will do afterwards is I will discuss how to get around some of the difficulties, not all of them, I won't have time for all of them, that arise when one goes from the Cantor set to a finite dimensional compact metric space. And for these things, in fact, the proof that I'll describe is the only proof known. There's a reduction in the criterion for tracial rank 0. So it suffices to prove, so A is a C-car algebra, unital and separable. Simple. It suffices to pull for some subset in A, which generates A as a C-span algebra. In other words, A is the closed linear span of the of all products, finite products of elements of S and their adjoints in arbitrary orders. And then the criterion looks more or less the same, except that we are going to use. Okay, I'm going to make one other change in it, which you'll see. But the main point is we're going to use elements of finite subsets of S rather than of A. So, for all F in S is finite, for all epsilon bigger than zero, and for all non-zero positive C in A, there is a projection P in A. And here's the other change which I'm going to make just for convenience. So I'm supposed to look at a finite dimensional subalgebra of PAP. And I'm going to put a unital AF algebra B contained in PAP such that I've got it a little bit differently here because this is how it's actually going to come out. B in A with P in B such that, and then we just have basically the same estimates. The norm of the commutators PA minus AP plus an epsilon for all A in F. The distance from PAP to PBP, the algebra, is less than epsilon for all A in F. And finally, 1, 2, and 3, 1 minus P is Murray the Neumann equivalent to a projection in the hereditary subalgebra coming through this non-zero positive element. So I'm not going to carry out the proof. I'm going to leave it as an exercise. For example, for this one, well, PBP is AF, so it might as well be finite dimensional for approximation purposes. For the other things, well, you have to show that, well, if you take some collection of star polynomials or things which are very closely approximable by them, then using a much smaller value epsilon, it suffices to look at just the things which appear in them as variables, essentially. This reminds me of the other exercise, the one I really do want to collect, which is find misprints in the notes. I've put things up on the website. There's a I maybe rearranged it since 2 weeks ago. It's on my homepage at the University of Oregon, and it says field course. And I replaced the lecture notes with an improved version about, I don't remember, I think it was within about 5 or 6 days ago or something like that. But it's still not final, though. I think I've got dates on them. I hope I have dates on them, anyway. Yes, that's the older one. So I think I put a date on the newer one as well. But it still says draft because it's still it's not finished. I mean, but I've not been working on them very much in the last little while. I've got me trying to do other things. Okay. So now I want some standard notation. for functures. This is supposed to apply whether X is the counter set or not. So I'm going to simply take A to be the cross product. And then I want a semi-algebra for Y contained in X closed. Take, or set, A sub Y to be the C-star semi-algebra of the cross product generated by C of X and U C0 of X minus Y. So here U is the standard unitary in the cross product. And this you can identify with a set of functions f in C of X such that f restricted to y is 0. So this is some C-star semi-algebra. I won't go into details here, and this is just sort of barely mentioned in the lecture notes. I might, if I get a chance sometime, expand that. But I should at least mention this because it's relevant to other things done with cross products. But this is a rather strange-looking algebra. It is less unnatural than one might think. How many people have heard of groupoids? I should say, how many people have not heard of groupoids? Okay, well, I'm not going to say very much about them. A groupoid is, it's sort of like it's sort of like a group, but there are a number of different identity elements. Just purely abstractly, take a collection of sets and take a specified collection of sets and then look at all bijections between sets in this collection. So a bijection from one set to the other is certainly invertible, there are two different identity elements, namely the identity functions of the two different sets. You can make a groupoid out of a group action on a set. Then there are things like subgroupoids and so on. If the groupoid is topological in an appropriate sense, then you can make the C-star algebra and the reduced C-star algebra of the groupoid. And the C-star algebra of the groupoid from the transformation group is just the C-star cross product. This thing is the C-star algebra of a particular subgroupoid. And the point here is that when you look at a transformation group, or any group action on a space, there aren't very many sub-objects, especially in the case of a minimal action where there aren't any closed sets you can restrict to. But there are a lot more subgroupoids. And I've worked also on actions of Z to the D, and in that situation, here one can simply carry out the proof and not notice that groupoids are involved. In fact, that's how it was first done, as far as I can tell anyway. There's no mention of, this algebra was introduced in the paper by Ian Putnam, and I don't think there's any mention of groupoids in that paper. It's true that Putnam has done a lot with groupoids, but I think that was mostly later. So you can go through, and I will, without actually talking about groupoids, but when you get to more complicated groups, then this becomes much more difficult, and you really want to use the terminology. I remember a talk by Ian Putnam at, it was a general audience talk at a CMS meeting in Victoria, and he was talking about groupoids. And he was making a comment. Well, he didn't really like the term. Groupoid sounds, he said, like a group with a disease. Which I didn't actually say it at the time, but my response is, well, yes, and you can identify the disease. It's schizophrenia, too many identities. There are a bunch of other things which end in oid in mathematics. There's a matroid, and I don't know, I'm not sure, there are algebroids of various sorts. I've even heard of something called a greedoid. I'm sorry?
Algorithm?
Well, it's related to an algorithm. Apparently, it's the minimum mathematical structure you need in order for the notion of a greedy algorithm to make sense. Greedy algorithm being a standard thing in optimization problems. I mean, it doesn't necessarily give particularly good results, but it never gives horrible results. And it's a simple algorithm. So there's about four or five lemmas then, which make up the proof for the Cantor set. So back to X is the Cantor set. And then I'm going to choose the sets Y typically to be compact open sets. So lemma. And this is due to Putnam. Let Y in X be non-empty compact open. Then A sub Y is an AF algebra. The cross product K1 is not zero because the class of the unitary generates something, but here the class of the unitary has been broken. By the way, this thing is, I mean, when X is not the Cantor set, then things get much worse. You don't have compact open sets to begin with. And that's one of the things that I will talk at least some about in the generalization. So, proof. The proof is going to take a little while, but the main thing which goes into it is the construction of Rochlin powers. So, claim. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to construct the Rochlin powers associated with this set Y. So the first step is some capital N such that the union from N equals 1 to capital N of H to the N of Y is all of X. Also, the proof of the claim. Well, we know, and this was from one of the one-sided conditions for minimality, that the union from n equals 1 to infinity of h to the n of y is equal to x. You know, I mean, basically, the complement say Z is a closed, right? This is an open set because Y is open, so it's a closed set with H of Z contained in, I guess it's H of Z isn't contained Z. So I have to use the one-sided criterion on H inverse. But now, X compact implies that I can choose a finite subcover, and I guess I'll do it like this. There's just finite subcover. Yeah, and that gives N. So now, I'll sort of just describe the construction. I'm going to define an assortment of things. For y in the set y, let r of y be the least n, which is equal to 1, such that h to the n of y is in capital Y. And I guess I actually want, I think I should have done that with h to the minus n up there, because this is y is contained in h to the minus n of y. Yes, so I've got to change this. That'll be a misprint in the notes. H to the minus n, so this one goes the other way around, and I want h to the minus n there. So, then by the claim, r of y exists and is less than or equal to capital N. Now, this is the same as y being an h to the minus n of capital Y. Okay, and this is called the first return time. And then I'm going to set, I'm going to let n of 0 less than n of 1 less than up to n of l be the distinct values that r of y takes on. Right, this is less than or equal to capital N. And I'm going to set y sub k to be the set of y in y, such that r of y is n of k. And one can check that y sub k is a compact open subset. So, for example, y sub 0 is equal to y intersect h to the minus n of 0 of y. Y1 is y intersect h to the minus n of 1 of y. But I'll have to throw out everything in y0, etc. But everything is both open and closed, and H is a homeomorphism, so there's no issue. Question? I'm sorry?
Just on the numbers,
you go back. H is my homeomorphism. Up there. Yeah, so I'm going to, so H and X are fixed throughout. Other questions? Okay, and so note that Y is the disjoint union from K equals 0 to L of Y sub K. And also, I note that X is the disjoint union from K equals 0 to L, disjoint union. So let me actually put a picture over here. I guess I've got room for it. So here are y0, y1. This thing along here is y. This is yl. And here is h of y0. And then I go up here. And here is h to the n of 0 minus 1 of y0. These things are all disjoint. Well, if there was something in the intersection of two of them, then if I moved down to y, then when I y0, then when I applied h that suitable number of times, I would get something in y0 that was up here. But that doesn't happen because it doesn't return to y0 until I get to the next one up here. And then this one comes down under h. So h moves things up, and it comes down under h, but it gets spread out over all of these things. We don't know where it ends up. And similarly here are further powers, and this one here is h to the n of 1 minus 1 of y1. And then finally I have up here h to the n of l minus 1 of yl. So here I'm going to put j equals 0 to n of k minus 1 of h to the j of yk. And this structure is referred to as a collection of Roehlin towers. Roehlin is somebody's name. It was originally Russian. This is the transliteration. Sometimes one sees it without the K. The letter in Russian is the one pronounced as CH in German. So there isn't really an equivalent in English. It was originally done in ergodic theory where you have a measure and there was one tower and then there's a small leftover which has measure less than epsilon. Here we make it exact. There's no leftover. But there are many towers. Now, for convenience with this choice of what a sub y is, where was it? Here. It turns out that one should in fact use that x is the disjoint union from k equals 0 to l of the disjoint union from j equals 1 to n of k of h to the j of yk. So all I've done is I've applied my homeomorphism h to that thing up there. It's certainly still true. It means that I'm not using the base, but I'm using instead the thing one above the top. And I want to call this set here xk. There is no picture in the notes, though there's somebody who will maybe try to figure out how to create a nice one for me. So there may eventually be one. It's not going to be for a while. So let pk in C of x be the characteristic function of xk. With projection. And then we claim pk commutes with a sub 1. It certainly doesn't commute with everything in A, because when I conjugate by the, well, unless there's only one tower, in which case things are sort of trivial. When I conjugate by the unitary U, I get the characteristic function of H of xk, and there's no reason to think that's the same as xk. In fact, if it were, then xk would either be emptied or the whole space. Okay, there are situations where you can have only one tower, in which case this becomes irrelevant. So first, well, certainly pk commutes with C of x. That part is easy enough. So I have to worry about, and I will go over here with it. Can I make sure I chose this the right PK here? I've got it in my notes, so. Where is it? Yeah. Okay, so log F in CLX satisfy F is equal to Y equals 0, and consider PK times UF. So I want to get this on the other side. I don't have no trouble with the F, but I've got to do something about that U. So this is U star PK UF. And now what's this? Well, U characteristic function of Z U star is the characteristic function of H of Z. So, I mean, you have to think carefully what you do, right? It's easy to get inverses in the wrong place. Remember that alpha of F is so UF U star is F composed with H inverse. So it sort of moves backwards in the functions and forwards in the sets. And if I didn't put an inverse there, I'd have to put an inverse there. Okay, so what is this then? So this is U times the characteristic function of H of XK, H inverse though, because I've got the U star in the wrong place. So when I take H inverse of it, well, I lose the top thing on the tower, and I pick up Y sub K. So this is equal to U, I've got now P minus the characteristic function of H to the N of K of Y, K, plus the characteristic function of YK times F. Now here comes the key point. Note that since H, N of K of YK and YK are contained in Y, and F restricted to Y is 0, so characteristic function H, N of K of Y, F is 0, and characteristic function YK times F is 0. So these errors here don't matter because when I multiply them by F, I get 0. And so this is then equal to UPF, which is UFP. PK. Where did I start losing the subscript? Here, that was supposed to be a PK. Okay, so this proves the point. So maybe I should make some sort of comment about what's actually happening here. On each of these towers, the homeomorphism acts simply like a shift. If we take this shift all the way out, then the cross product by the shift is just the compact operator censored the continuous functions on whatever the base space of your shift is. So this is very easy to understand. Of course, it's not a shift all the way out, but by looking at functions which vanish on Y, we've sort of broken things when the shift stops being true. If you're doing this in the phenomenon algebra situation, then you want to approximate in a strong operator topology. If you take Y to be small, the characteristic function of Y is small. Anything you multiply by the characteristic function of the complement of Y, and that doesn't change things very much. And there is your approximation of the cross product by a finite dimensional algebra. Well, you'll see exactly why it's finite dimensional shortly. This gives you the proof, for example, that of hyperfiniteness of cross products by ergodic actions of integers. And it's quite easy, but in this case, the norm of the characteristic function of Y isn't small, so we have to work much harder. Um, On the other hand, what we are going to get is, for each of those towers, we're going to get a copy of the matrices. So, it's enough now. To prove that PK is AF, and we claim it's isomorphic to the N of K by NK matrices tensor C of YK. And this is AS because YK is totally disconnected. And you can more or less see the matrix units. The U moves each of these up to the next level, and that gives you E. I think it should be J plus 1 comma J. But I'll actually write down some details here. I didn't in the Ottawa lectures, and it's actually not written properly in the lecture notes yet, but I probably ought to actually demonstrate it. So, now I really don't want to. So in fact, there is CK, PK, AY, PK, goes to that thing, such that CK of F is the diagonal F composed with H restricted to YK, F composed with H to the N of K restricted to YK. And PK of characteristic function H to the J plus 1 of YK, U characteristic function H to the J of YK is the matrix unit E J plus 1 comma J tensor 1. And this is the standard matrix unit. Okay. I actually don't need to put these things on both sides, but it's sort of convenient for display purposes. Because if I take U times this times U star, that gives me that one. Now, actually, I'm going to construct a map going the other way and show it's an isomorphism. Okay, so we'll set define V I comma J in PK AY PK by V I comma J. So this is for I bigger than or equal to J. This is characteristic function H to the I don't need that restriction yet. This characteristic function of H to the I of YK, U to the I minus J, and characteristic function H to the J of YK. And once again, I don't actually need things on both sides, but I'll put them there. And we know that these act like matrix units, the I, say, J1, I say I1, I2, VJ1, J2 is delta I2, J1, V, I1, J2. And I'll check this. So again, the key point is noticed is that U characteristic function of say Z U star is characteristic function of H of Z. Right, this is the thing which we're using time and time again. And so this is for take 1 less than or equal to J to I and J less than or equal to N. And now I claim all VI J are in PK AY PK. So for I equal J, this is clear, it's in C of X. In fact, in C of XK. We'll do this for I bigger than J, and then resolve for I less than J, followed by taking adjoints. So for I less than J, but if I go back to the thing with U in it, so for I bigger than J, VIJ is characteristic function of H I of YK, U characteristic function H I minus 1 of YK, U, so I don't need to write another copy of the characteristic function of H I minus 1 of YK, etc. Well, I'll put one more thing here, H minus I minus 2, I minus 2 of yk, and then down to u, and then characteristic function of h to the j plus 1 of yk, u characteristic function h to the j of yk. And this thing is in a sub y, since the characteristic function part vanishes on y. And the reason is that since J now is less than N, what, N of K, the characteristic function H to the J of YK vanishes on Y. And the same thing applies to all the rest of them. Same reasoning shows that all these things in AY for the same reason. Maybe I is equal to N of K, but it doesn't matter. Right, this thing is in C of X. Also, I don't even actually need that factor. Okay, and then also clearly, so in fact, easy to check. In PK, AY, PK. Okay, so now, so we have a homomorphism, P0, MN of K, to PK, AY, PK, such that C0 of EIJ is VIJ. And I should say we have a unit homomorphism. So there are the matrices. So notice, for example, I mean, if I try to use U from up on the top one here, actually it's one higher up. Mark it in red. Try to use U here, then I end up somewhere, I don't know where down there. But I can get back to this thing by using u to the minus n of 0. Or maybe it's minus n of 0 plus 1, something like that. Those if I use a negative power. So the matrices are all there. Let's see. Maybe I should leave this picture. Leave that picture there. So the part shown in pink is the tower I'm actually working with. I should label this. Okay, X0. But remember that that pink thing on the top is really pieces down there. So now, define V1 C of YK to PK. Okay. Again, you do homomorphism. Why? Well, first of all, for F in C of YK, interpret F as in C of Y as F of X equals F of X when X is in YK and zero otherwise. And now set C1 and F. So I want to get the diagonal matrix with constant F on the diagonal. And those things, what that really means is they live on these various different sets, so I have to get them there. So it's F composed with H inverse plus F composed with H minus 2. Make sure I'm actually getting the formula right here. Plus, et cetera, plus up to F composes H to the minus N of K. Now, I should tell you what this means about the inverse of when I put them together, so I'm going to make a homomorphism out into the tensor product out of these two things. The inverse of phi which is supposed to go from M N of K tensor C of YK to A PK A Y PK will send some F, well maybe I should call it G, in C of XK to the matrix diagonal of F, sorry, it's G now, H of YK, G restricted to H squared of YK, G restricted to H to the N of K of YK. So what does that mean? It means I have a function defined on the pink tower, and I get the diagonal entries of my matrix by simply restricting the function to each of those levels. So, in my diagonal matrix, so first of all, the inverse actually sends a function to a diagonal matrix. Well, C of YK is supposed to land in a commutative subalgebra, and the diagonal matrices are a good example. So, the 1-1 entry is F restricted to that piece. The 2-2 entry is F restricted to that piece. The 3-3 entry is F restricted to that piece. And the last diagonal entry is F restricted to that piece. And in general, there's no problem with this B of 1 being a homomorphism, because these things here have disjoint supports. Question?
When you wrote there, like, don't you have to kind of move the G-though, like, move the
G-though, yes, you're right. Thank you. Thank you. This needs to be, it should be diagonal of probably G composed with H restricted to YK is what I should really do here. Oh, way over there. Yes, okay. Yeah. Well, so I want to say, let me actually put it back the way it was, because it intuitively makes more sense this way. I'll put this in quotation marks. Diagonal of G restricted to H of YK. So I'll put quotation marks around, because essentially this is what I'm doing. And then, so normalize, if you will, to be functions on YK. So this is what's really happened. Okay, I'm about to erase it. I was repeating myself. I had forgotten how we sort of said this. Okay, so we check easily that C1 of F commutes with Vij for all F, I, and J. Right, since essentially I'm using the same thing on each of those levels, and I'll proof check this. And therefore, is that a question? So we get C0, C1 give a homomorphism C from C of, sorry, M of the order, M N of K, tensor C of 1K goes to PK AYK. Now, actually, this is bijective. So check, so claim C is injective. Well, you can figure, you know what the ideals in this are, they all come from that. So this follows from C1 injective and MNFK simple. And then we claim C is surjective. Well, so certainly C of XK is contained in the range. Right, in fact, if F is in C of XK, then I want to go up here next, right? F is equal to phi of the sum from J equals 1 to N of K of EJJ tensor. And now I've got to take F composed with H to the, what, probably minus J. I probably wrote a formula here, and let me just check. Where is it? Okay, I wrote the formula wrong, but it should be F composed H to the minus J restricted to YK. Is that right? Probably want H to the J here. Yeah, because I want to take the value of F on H to the J of YK, and then I want to rearrange it to be a function on YK. So this gives values of F on H to the J of YK, and that's the right thing. So think of this as F restricted to H to the J of YK. And then the other thing I've got to show is that so we also need that U characteristic function of xk take away yk. Sorry, that's not the quite correct. It's U pk U characteristic function of x minus y pk. We need this is in the range of phi. It's not quite xk take away yk because it's xk take away the thing on the top instead. But what is it? This is phi of the sum over j equals 1 to n of k minus 1 now of e j plus 1 comma j tensor 1. And then we get pk u characteristic function x minus y f pk in the range by just multiplication. Right, I'm supposed to look at arbitrary functions which vanish on y. Well, they have the form characteristic function x minus y times something. I mean. Okay, so this proves surjectivity. And that proves dilemma. And I'm slightly past the usual break time. We'll stop now. And we'll start again in 10 minutes. Is the sound on?
Can't kill everybody.
I hope so.
Okay, so the timing is actually slightly awkward. I've got several pre-runners with fairly short folks, and then the next one is the other main lemma, and I will certainly not get finished with its proof, but I may get sort of to it. We'll see how things work. Okay. So that was the last place I wrote. I guess I'll make a brief comment, which I was actually saying at some point in between, about what happens in the general case. If X is, say, connected, there are, of course, no non-trivial compact open sets. As you will see in the rest of the proof, it is necessary to choose Y to be non-empty and small. Well, I mean, that you want to approximate U better than you have to make bigger towers. So it turns out that what you have to do is the following. You take Y to be closed and have non-empty interior. Then you define the partition by the first return time, but the sets are no longer closed. The first one will be closed, but later on they're just intersections of open and closed sets because you have to delete parts of the previous ones. And for these things, you use the closures. The closures are, in general, not disjoint anymore. In particular, it means that over here, for example, there may be some things in this tower which return here. The projections P sub k that I had, which are the characteristic functions of the things in the towers, well, the union of the sets in the tower is no longer open, although it's still closed, and so P sub k isn't in the algebra. What you get then when you take the A sub Y is some sub-algebra of the direct sum. Where is it? I should still have a copy of it somewhere. Is it gone? No, the algebra, the direct sum of, yeah, up there. Okay, so what I showed is that A sub Y in the counter-set case is isomorphic to the direct sum of those things, of these. And in the general case, it is isomorphic to a sub-algebra of this direct sum. This sub-algebra turns out to have a special structure, what Ching Lin and I called a recursive homogeneous C-star algebra. There's a recursive definition implicit in it, and this structure is absolutely crucial to work on the general case. Furthermore, the definition is you can try to write down exactly which subalgebra you get, and the result, the description will be absolutely horrible. The notion of a recursive homogeneous C-star algebra is an abstraction of the essential points of the structure. It's easy to prove theorems about them, basically by induction, since they're defined recursively. Whereas if you try to work with the actual description you get out of a minimal homeomorphism, it will be awful. So I'm not sure how much of that, if I finish this proof and then I could spend the entire remaining period talking only about recursive homogeneous C-star algebras. I don't really want to do that. So let's go on then. Back to assuming that X is the Cantor set. So the lemma which I proved was about the structure of A sub Y. And so this lemma which is about Murray binomial equivalence in A sub Y, a special case of it, let Y in X be compact open. Suppose that Y, H of Y, up to H to the capital N of Y are disjoint. Then the characteristic function of Y, well, this is an element in C of X, which is therefore contained in the cross product, is Murray binomial equivalent to the characteristic function of H to the capital N of Y in A sub Y. So this needs a comment. It's trivial in A, using again the formula U characteristic function of Z, U star is characteristic function of H of Z in simply iterating. Yes? Well, it's actually true for anything up to capital N, but I mean, I could simply choose, all I'm assuming is that these are disjoint, I can simply go all the way up there. So let me rewrite that a little bit differently. Let me write this as take, or this is unitary equivalence, let me just write the Murray binomial equivalence so it'll be sort of clearer what's actually needed here. If I take V to be U times characteristic function of Z, one gets that V star V is characteristic function of Z, and V star is the characteristic function of H of Z. Well, note that if Z intersect Y is not empty, then V is not in A sub Y. Right, because I'm supposed to say U times things that vanish on Y, and the characteristic function of Z won't vanish on Y. So in particular, if I take Z equals Y, then I'm in trouble. Well, the lemma is true anyway. Otherwise, at least I hope, otherwise I wouldn't be writing it here. So for the proof, so by the calculation, by the comment, if Z intersect Y is empty, this implies that a characteristic function of Z is equivalent to, oh dear, a characteristic function of H of Z in H of Y. In particular, characteristic function of H of Y is equivalent to characteristic function of H squared of Y, equivalent to, et cetera, up to characteristic function of H to the capital N of Y, because all these things are disjoint from Y. Also, characteristic function of X minus Y is equivalent to characteristic function of x minus h of y. In h of y, actually right here, in h of y. Okay, and this is 1 minus the characteristic function of y is equivalent to 1 minus the characteristic function of h of y. But h of y is an AF algebra, and projection satisfies by cancellation. So the characteristic function of y is equivalent to the characteristic function of h sub y in h sub y. When I try to redo this without the counter set, then I have Chris's homogeneous algebra. You don't have cancellation. You take the direct limit as the sets. You take a bunch of these sets y up and sink to a point. The direct limit is something with slow dimension growth, and therefore has stable rank 1. That's a theorem, and so it's cancellation. So it still works. But in not quite as meaningful. No longer true in A sub y, but still in some useful subalgebra. Okay, I guess I'm not going to need this picture again. So this is the one I say, now on your main lemma, which I'll call, lemma. And let me give this also a title, small in C of X implies small in the cross product. That's an A here. So I'm thinking of projections, and small means, well, small in trace or Murray Van equivalent to a subprojection of some given something or other. And here's the statement. So H and X still is above, also A. In particular, X is still a Cantor set. And let C in A be non-zero, positive. Then there exists a non-zero projection P in C of X such that P is Murray von Neumann equivalent to a projection in the hereditary subalgebra generated by C. Well, what's the point of this? Well, I want to verify the condition for tracial rank 0. And it says I'm supposed to make sure the leftover is dominated by an arbitrary hereditary subalgebra in the cross product. Well, I don't know what the cross product is when I'm doing this. The kind of control I do have is I can make sure the leftover is controlled by some subset of X. And this lemma guarantees that, in fact, that's enough to make it controlled by your thing in the hereditary subalgebra. And something like this seems to be necessary in all the structure proofs that I've done for cross products. Although I'm not quite sure that it's recognizable in this proof from, as far as I can tell, the idea here goes back to Jiang, who was working on cross products of purely infinite simple C-star algebras by finite groups. Proof. Let E. So I talked about conditional expectations last time. I haven't used it yet. Here it comes. Then E of C is a non-zero non-negative function on X. Right, this is because the conditional expectation is faithful. So I'm really using here the fact that the full and reduced cross products are the same. I suppose otherwise I could simply say everything for the reduced cross product. So choose a compact open K0 in X and delta bigger than 0 such that E of C restricted to K0 is bigger than 4 delta as a function on K0. Choose B equals the sum from N equals minus capital N to capital N, Dn U to Dn. Yeah. Such that norm of B minus C is less than what I want, delta. Right, elements in the cross product can be approximated by finite sums. But remember that I can't simply take some of the coefficients of C here. That doesn't converge in general. But for present purposes, it doesn't matter. I suppose if you want, you could take the, what is the summation that's used for Fourier series? Cesaro sum, yes. I want to say Thayer, but that's not it. Okay. So, choose using the freeness of the action. K contained in K0, non-empty, compact, open, such that H to the minus N of K, H minus N plus 1 of K, etc., H to the plus N of K are disjoint. Set P characteristic function of K. What I want to note is that P U to the N P is 0 for N in this range, except of course for 0. Because in fact P U to the N P U to the minus N is characteristic function of K times characteristic function of H to the N of K. That's a minus N here. Okay, so now when I compute PBP, P commutes with the BNs. Right, the BNs are in C of X. And I get that it's equal to P B0 P. Okay, and this is of course equal to P E of B P. So now let's compare E of C with E of B. So the norm PCP minus P E of C P All right, this one we actually know something about. See, we don't. It's less than or equal to the norm of PCP minus PBP plus the norm of PBP minus PE of BP plus the norm of PE of BP minus PE of CP. This is less than or equal to norm C minus B, less than delta. Similarly, this one is also less than delta. That one is zero. That's the calculation I just did over there. So the whole thing is less than 2 delta. Okay, so now the conclusion is that this guy is invertible. This one's close to that one. So this one is invertible, but in the corner. Right? So working in PAP, PE of CP is invertible with the norm of the inverse less than, what was it, 1/4 delta inverse. So say 1/4 delta. Norm of PCP minus PEFCP is less than 2 delta. So PCP is invertible in PAP. And now I simply have to write down a formula. I'll set, let A be PCP to the minus 1/2, calculated in this corner. Let's see. Sorry?
What was that? Square root of the positive square root.
Yes. Yes, usual. Is it still visible there? Yes. And the right piece of paper. Yeah, here we go. And then set V equals A P C to the 1/2. And then let's calculate. V star V is, I want V star first, right? I want V star. I wrote it as V star V in my notes, unfortunately, but anyway, it's A P C to the 1/2 P A, sorry, right, C not P to the 1/2, because I'm multiplying this times C to the 1/2 P A, which is P C P minus 1/2 P C P P C P minus 1/2 equals P, and V star V is C to the 1/2 A P A C to the 1/2 which is certainly in C A C closure. Okay, so here's a Murray binomial equivalence of that A, that's gotta be a projection, and it's in there. I'm not really sure exactly how to motivate this trick. But some variant of it was discovered, I guess it was by Jung, and it's now, I guess, become a fairly standard thing.
What
does this mean? Well, this, right, this functional calculus sort of argument here, right? Here, where's the lemma is up here, right? A projection. Right, you take a small rotary subalgebra of the cross product, then there's a projection in C of X that's equivalent to a. Maybe it was maybe it first appeared elsewhere. I don't know, but.
Anyway, I guess there's a long history of studying the cross product in terms of the original algebra production from the K theory of the cross product from the K theory of the original algebra.
Yeah, on the other hand, you don't use anything like this when you're doing the Pinsker-Barkowski exact sequence, as far as I know. The key point here is that I want to make something small in A, which is the cross product, and it suffices to make it small in C of X.
For instance, if you look at Putnam's work, he has to prove that when you look at the cross product and the K0 group of the positive cone of the K0 group of the cross product is the image of the positive cone of the K0 of the original community.
Yeah, okay, maybe something like this was in there, I don't know. I've certainly seen this kind of thing in several places by now. But okay. So now, scrambled my page notes. Where is the right page? Here we go. So I'm going to start then. On the other main lemma, and this is, I guess, the main Kirchhoff approximation lemma. So again, X, H, A as above. Well, I don't know, probably not above anymore, maybe it's even erased. Y in X fixed. This is actually lowercase y. For epsilon bigger than 0, for all u in x open, not empty, that's size control, and for all finite subsets of C of x, there exists a compact open set y containing little y, and a projection P in A sub Y, such that now we have these traceable approximation things. One, norm P A minus AP is less than epsilon for all A in F union just the standard unitary. So remember at the beginning I said I was going to work with a generating set. My generating set is C of X together with that one standard unitary. Two, norm of, the distance from PAP to PA sub Y, P, is less than epsilon. Again, for all A in the same place. And three, is that P, 1 minus P is, let me put it like this. There is a compact open set Z contained in U such that 1 minus P is more of an Armand equivalent to the characteristic function of Z. So this is how we're saying that 1 minus P is small. Okay, so I'm basically just going to get to sort of the setup. Maybe I should, instead of starting the setup, try to describe the main idea, and then you can sort of think about it over the next week, and then I will come back and carry out the details of it. So the main idea is what's known as Berg's technique. Let me start off with just, I guess, a sort of simple example, which doesn't have a space or anything like that on it. What it shows is that the bilateral shift is approximately unitarily equivalent, and how good the approximation is depends on the size of the thing to be mentioned, to its direct sum with a cyclic shift. So I want to think right now of things which correspond to standard basis vectors in little L2 of Z. And I'm going to, so the bilateral shift moves them sideways, but I'm going to put them in a funny arrangement. We'll start coming in here. And I will go down here and back. And let me change the colors. All right, light green. Okay, so here's a picture of the bilateral shift arranged in a funny way. Actually, I don't need anything down. I can just go from here directly to here. Although in when I get to the minimal homeomorphism case, I won't be able to do that. Well, it means that I don't need all these extra things in the middle. I mean, the diagram will still work if I arrange them just like that. Yes, that's right. In this picture so far, it's purely combinatorial. Distances are only there for the purpose of making a description of what happens. When I get to the minimal diffeomorphism or minimal homeomorphism case, this is going to be an orbit in the space X, and the distances become real. Essentially what I want to do is I want, at this stage, when I go from here to here, I want to twist things a little bit. So I think of this as being a copy of the 2x2 matrices, 2x2 matrices. So these are really the, bounded operators on the span of those two basis vectors. And the standard map from one M2 to the next is simply, well, effectively the identity. So I'm so careful, I'm sort of identifying them in the same way as I go across. is the identity if I make the obvious identification. What I want to do instead is I want to move over and I want to conjugate by I need more space there, cosine of it should be pi over 2n, sine of pi over 2n, minus sine pi over 2n, cosine of pi over 2n. And what this does call this equals W. So W star. So E11 here is the projection on the basis vector corresponding to the white point. Is not close to E11. They're not equal to it, but we have picked up a bit of E22, and this comes from the green point. Yes. So what I'm actually going to do then is, I'm going to take a unitary on my Hilbert space, which doesn't do anything on most of the points, but on the span of those two points, the unitary is a copy of W. On the span of those two points is another copy of W. And similarly, all the way across to there. It should be here, I guess. So I then follow what happens. The rank one projection here gets sent to the rank one projection. Well, the basis vector here gets sent to the basis vector there. It gets sent to this one. Then it gets sent to some linear combination of these two, but mostly that one. But then I'm applying W again. So if I square W, I have 2 pi over 2n and so on here. If I do it n times, then I've got 0, 1, minus 1, 0. And so if I follow this basis vector here, it gets moved a little bit over here, it gets moved further over, and by the time it gets here, it's come down to there. And then it goes on out there, whereas the other part goes around. Yes?
I don't know if it makes any difference, but do you take the conjugate by W or just apply W?
So if I'm going to track what happens on the basis vectors, then I simply apply W in these various places. If I want to claim that my shift is approximately unitarily equivalent to the direct sum of a shift and the cyclic shift, then I have to actually conjugate by W. But for the present purposes, it's probably better to think of it as actually just applying W, although I don't have basis vectors sitting around when I get to the minimal homeomorphism case, and I'm going to have to do this. I'm going to have to conjugate by something.
Where do the powers of W go?
So when I look at so when I look at say what should I call it? The unitary which acts like W on each of the boxed pairs. Well, actually, no, that's overly complicated. Right. The shift sends one thing to the next, to the next, to the next, and so on. So I look at this thing here. I want its image under my slightly perturbed shift to be somewhere in this box. The image of that box to be inside the next box I didn't draw, and so on. But if I take a large power of the shift before perturbing it, if I take the nth power, this thing goes over to there. Whereas if I take the nth power after perturbation, this thing goes over to there. So what happens? Well, I take the first power, I've applied W in that box, and I've landed to something somewhere close to the white dot, but not exactly there. Then when I apply the thing again, when I take the second power, I apply W in this box, and that gets me a little bit closer to the green one, and so on. So the second power of my perturbed shift involves, if I apply it here, two powers of W. Well, because when I if I use W in here instead of just simply going over by the identity, then it's not the same operator. It's close. So the key point here, among other things, is that W is close to 1. So if I tried to do it all at once, I would have some large power of W. It wouldn't be close to 1. But I've got a copy of W there, a copy of W there, a copy of W all the way across. They're on orthogonal pieces of the space, and so the norm of the thing is still close. So the thing is still close to 1 in norm.
It's not that you're showing that two things are approximately unitary equivalent. It's two things that are exactly unitary equivalent, which are approximately the same. That's what I mean.
Yes, but then I can sort of yes, but then that's the same as an approximate unitary equivalent.
Huh?
But then if they're exactly unitary equivalent and approximate. Okay, but what do I have then? Right, I have something which here, which then looks like, right, the thing which comes here and then ends up with the green one there. It looks like the bilateral shift. And so I say, well, I have to direct some of the shift in something else, and I have a unitary which implements that. So this shift is close to something which is unitarily equivalent to the direct sum of the bilateral shift and a finite cyclic shift.
Can you do that with two infinite shifts? Instead of an infinite one and a finite one?
I don't know. It's not totally trivial.
The unilateral shift is the same thing.
Yeah, no. But he wants to know if say if the bilateral shift is approximately direct sum to approximately unitary equivalent to the direct sum of two copies of itself. Yes,
sure.
And the answer, I mean, surely it has to be yes. Only I don't.
Sure.
Yes,
presumably
using Burke's technique, but you.
Yeah, you need you certainly have to have a different picture. I don't see it offhand. And
well, you just do it. You think you cyclic shifts, and you can just cut those, attach those.
Okay, so you split off a long cyclic shift and a longer cyclic shift, and so on, and you stick them all together. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That'll do it. So it's a bunch of copies of this picture with larger and larger segments, and then you stick together afterwards what you get in a similar way.
Once you have the direct sum of the whole logic. Larger and larger cyclic chip, then you
splice them together in the same way.
Then you get one small cyclic chip, but then you just embed all that into one copy of the platinum chip. So is that something that's useful? I mean, that's something that's in the known application, is divide out a chip and two copies of it?
Well, I mean, you could do this not only for this the unweighted chip, you could do this for weighted chips, and then that would be very easy.
Yeah, I mean, Berg's technique was invented by Berg. I mean, I've been told that, stone check compactification, sometimes known as the check compactification, was invented by Tychonoff, and that Tychonoff's theorem was proved by check. Berg's technique, as far as I know, really was invented by Berg, and it was for operator theoretic purposes. He threw stones at the other two. It had applications there, and I don't remember what the applications were. It was Ian Putnam that introduced, as far as I know, can tell Berg's technique into operator algebras. I don't know whether I want to apply this sort of double thing to a cross product usefully or not. I mean, anyway, it's 5 after the end of the period, so I will stop, and I will see you next week.